In 2011, our next guest wrote the book Aretha Franklin's Amazing Grace, 33 and a Third, a fascinating exploration of the best-selling gospel album of all time. Now, the long-buried concert film Amazing Grace is coming to theaters this year. Aaron Cohen, welcome to Cattlecast.
Well, thank you very, very much for having me.
Now, Amazing Grace marked Aretha Franklin's return to her gospel roots after she had already earned 11 consecutive number one pop and R&B singles, won 5 Grammy Awards, and released more than 20 albums. What made her go back to her roots and do these gospel songs?
Well, there were a lot of reasons for her to go back, personally, as well as a reason for Atlantic to release the record. On the personal level with Aretha Franklin, she had never left the church. She had always maintained ties to the church tradition. She had always been a regular at the church. And of course, her father, the Reverend C.L. Franklin, was a very prominent Baptist minister at that time. And so she was always engaged in that tradition, even if that's not what she was recording in the early and mid 1960s. There were a lot of things that were going on in terms of her family life, in terms of her mentors in the church, like Clara Ward, who was present during the recording. Clara Ward was from that earlier generation of gospel artists, as was Mahalia Jackson. And that earlier generation was on the way, they were sort of retreating from public view. In fact, that was not long before Mahalia Jackson's death. So I think for Aretha Franklin, there was maintaining, strengthening that tie to that earlier generation of gospel artists who she had grown up working with as a young girl, singing with, being a protege of. So I think that she was responding to that, passing the torch, as it were. There was also her reemergence in terms of thinking about black consciousness at that time because of the people she was with, like Ken Cunningham, who was her partner at that time, who was very much involved with the black arts movement in New York. At that time, with Reverend James H. Cone and other African-American theologians, there was a strength that gospel music was the pure black music, that it had been unadulterated from interaction with white influences. And I think Aretha Franklin was very strongly identifying with that, not just as a gospel performer, as a singer, but also when you look at the cover art for the album as well.
And what was the significance of the recording location of Amazing Grace? And we're talking about 1972?
January 1972. Let me also say at that time, and this goes back to the record's release, I was going to mention this earlier, but gospel is becoming significant crossover business as well. There was Oh Happy Day, the gospel crossover hit. There were songs like My Sweet Lord. There was the popular Jesus Christ Superstar musical. So Atlantic Records certainly knew that there was money to be made in gospel. So the producer, Jerry Wexler, was certainly amenable to, from a commercial standpoint, to Aretha's request to record this album. Now, to answer your question about the church, this was the New Temple Missionary Baptist Church in Watts. So the connection with her father's church was very strong. It was the same denomination. But also Watts at that time was certainly the heart of African-American Los Angeles. Certainly there was the Watts Uprising a few years earlier, and then shortly thereafter was the Watts Stax concert. So Watts, a church in Watts, especially an old traditional church in Watts, had a very strong tie to the surrounding African-American community. Also, Los Angeles was the home of the Reverend James Cleveland, who was a longtime friend and associate of Aretha's, who had also become a great innovator in terms of gospel choirs and the gospel choir tradition. So having James Cleveland in Los Angeles was certainly a part of it, as well as Aretha Franklin wanting to become involved in other aspects of arts entertainment industry, including film and television at that time.
Sure. Now, the film was originally directed by Sidney Pollack, But yes, there were some technical issues that caused the film to go unreleased.
Yes. The sound and images, the clapper, which would synchronize the sound and images, were not synchronized properly when the film was made. So that was one reason why it sat unreleased for many, many years, was because the technology did not exist to properly sync up the sound and image. I'm going to try to condense this very long, involved, complicated story, but in the 2000s, producer Alan Elliott was able to get the rights to the film footage, and he was able to use technology. He was able to use rely on very good editing, as well as lip syncing, as well as his own musical expertise to finish the film.
Wow, that's sounds like tedious work, but the end result, I'm sure, is amazing. And
let's just say it's very, very labor intensive work. I saw the raw footage. Alan was very kind to show me the raw footage when I started working on the book in 2009, and then I saw the finished version for the first time after I finished the book in 2011, and then I saw a version that came out, that's coming out now, and the technical work that went into it is just beyond belief.
And we should say that this is more than just a concert film. What are viewers going to see when they watch this?
What viewers will see, which of course they would know going into the film, was how magnificently Aretha Franklin sings. And they would also see that, but one of the things that they'll be very interested to see is that Aretha Franklin, even though she had that reputation of being a diva, reputation of being a star performer, as the footage shows in the film, she was very happy to collaborate. She was happy to step back and listen to other people who would give direction. She was working as an equal with everyone. She was a team player, which is as important to any great artist as one's own individual accomplishment. So that comes out very strongly in the film. The film will also show how much a part of the community this performance was, how in the back and forth with her and the congregation and her father and her group, that this was a living community, that it wasn't some, you know, stage event where it was performer on stage separate from everyone else. Everybody was there together in so many senses of the word.
And you've talked a little bit about this, but how did this movie finally get released after all these years?
Well, again, I have to condense quite a lot because it's a very long, involved story. But Aretha Franklin, for various reasons, did not want it released at the time of Alan Elliott's involvement. After her passing, her niece, Sabrina Owens, who is in charge of her estate, agreed for the film to be released. And so with the blessing of Aretha Franklin's estate, all of those legal hurdles were cleared and they were able to bring it to theaters.
Well, I know people are going to enjoy seeing it, and as well as reading your book, too, with the behind the scenes of all of that. Now, we should also mention that you're working on a new book that comes out later this year. What can you share with us about this new title?
My next book is called Move On Up, Chicago Soul Music and Black Cultural Power. It is coming out this September from the University of Chicago Press, and it looks at the social and cultural forces here in Chicago that shaped soul music in the city primarily during the 1960s and 1970s, and also how the musicians themselves were direct change agents here in Chicago.
Very cool. We'll look forward to seeing that one, too.
Well, thank you very, very much.
The book Amazing Grace 33 and a Third is still available for purchase, and the film Amazing Grace will be in theaters very soon. Aaron Cohen, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you so very much for having me.